calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, should it be the Flying Spaghetti Monster? Was Flying Spaghetti Monster a deity founded, discovered, revealed in 2005 by Bobby Henderson at Oregon State University? The Pastafarians? The invisible and undetectable Flying Spaghetti Monster created the universe, including a mountain, trees, and a midget. All evidence for evolution was planted by the Flying Spaghetti Monster. For example, according to the religion, a scientist may perform a carbon dating process on an artifact. He finds that approximately 75% of the carbon-14 has been decayed to nitrogen-14 and infers that this artifact is 11,000 years old. In fact, what the scientist does not realize is that every time he makes a measurement, the Flying Spaghetti Monster is there changing the results with his noodly appendage. Henderson is now suggesting that the Flying Spaghetti Monster should be taught in our public schools. Dr. Ronald Rollins is the author of a book called God, the Intelligent Designer, and he is suggesting that the age of the planet as being 6,000 years, Mr. Rollins?
Yes.
Should be taught in our public schools. The website Kiwi Publishing, KIWEPublishing.com, if I'm mispronouncing that, please correct me. Ronald Rollins, the author of God, the Intelligent Designer. Sir, why should this be taught in our schools as science?
Well, one side says the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. The other side says it's 6,000 years old. And there is evidence that the Earth has been formed and created from pre-existing material that could be as old as you want, billions of years old, but the process only started 13,000 years ago.
The other side of what?
Are you
suggesting of science?
Well, yes, there's evidence both from science and also from Scripture, from the Bible.
Right. Now I'm assuming that you're drawing, well, not just assuming, I actually have spent some time with your book. You're clearly drawing a lot, although there is a fair amount of, quoted science in the book. And frankly, I want to acknowledge you. There's one place where you were talking about these, the footprints of humans next to dinosaurs, and you point out that this was the result of a hoax. These guys were aging the footprints and with acid and selling them, although you believe that there may be others that weren't hoaxes. But nonetheless, you're pretty straightforward about this stuff. But you're basing a lot of this on Scripture. We have both read the Bible. I don't recall anywhere in the Bible where it says that the world is 6,000 years old. What did I miss?
Well, Peter tells us that one day unto the Lord is as 1,000 years, that his manner of reckoning time is that one of his days is equal to 1,000 of our years. So in Genesis, when it says that he created the earth and everything on it in 6 days, he's talking about his days, not our days, which would be 6,000 of our years. And then it's been 6,000 years since Adam, so that makes 12,000. He rested a day, so that makes 13,000. And that makes the earth only 13,000 years old, although is created from material that's much older.
What if Peter was wrong?
Let me say it this way. In science, when they find a rock and they date it at 4.5 billion years old, they say the earth must be that old because they found a piece of it that is. But let's consider a building. Let's say a building is made of material that's 1,000 years old. And the building was finished last week. How old is the building? That's 1 week old. And the earth is a building constructed of material that has been around for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. But the organization process just started 13,000 years ago.
Christianity is a significant religion in the world. There's probably about 1.5 billion Christians. The Catholic Church itself claims 1 billion Catholics. About 3 years ago, they claimed that they had surpassed the 1 billion number. But there are more Muslims in the world than there are Christians. There are probably at least as many Hindus in the world as there are Christians. There are, and then there are, you know, other, I mean, you know, 6.5 billion people in the world and probably 1.5 billion Christians. Why not look to, for example, Hinduism? The Hindu creation myth actually incorporates millions of years into its time frame. The Buddhist creation myth includes millions of years in its time frame. I'm not sure, frankly, what the Islamic creation myth, you know, it's based in the Old Testament, but they don't, but they acknowledge the New Testament not as being infallible as you are. And so, you know, I doubt that they would take that literally. Why pick one particular religion's creation myth and teach that in our schools as science? Why not have all of the various religions of the world, including the Pastafarians, have their creation myths taught as part of comparative religion and leave the science to the scientists?
That's a good thought. My comment to that would be don't present it as a hard fact cast in stone. Let me say it this
way. No pun intended.
that present it as one possibility and here's another possibility. And let me say it another way. If you think back 20, 30, 40 years ago, depending on how old you are, and when you were in school, the science that you were being taught was being taught as true. The science that's being taught in school today is being taught as true, and it's practically all changed. It's been updated and corrected.
Actually, I was taught that scientific theory is a process of rigorously determining the validity of things, and that there's a process to that. And you don't take things on faith in science. You take things on evidence, and the evidence is that the planet is more than 13,000 years old. There's, I would say, most people would agree, overwhelming evidence of that. So I don't get it why you would want kids to be confused about this. Here's a larger question. You, in your belief, in your faith, believe this to be true, but why is it important to you personally with regard to your particular faith to hold this tenet? I mean, if somebody were to demonstrate to you that the world was not created 13,000 years ago, that wouldn't cause your faith in Christianity to crumble, would it?
No.
Okay, then why push this so hard here, Dr. Rollins?
I believe that if something is true, it's true. Whether you learn it from science or whether you learn it from religion or whether you learn it from your own thinking or logic or whatever, if it's true, it's true, and it has to be in agreement. Truth from one source cannot be in conflict with truth from another source.
But science is never absolute truth, and neither is religion. Why not teach science as science and talk about, you know, scientific debate and talk about the scientific method and teach comparative religion as comparative religion? And if we're going to get into creation myths, compare them. I mean, there are probably dozens of different creation myths just in North America as a consequence of native folks who were living here before Europeans like you and I showed up.
Oh, okay, let me clarify one other thing. Yes, as a scientist, I'm also a Christian and a strong believer in my faith. But intelligent design is not based on the Bible or Scripture or religion.
Then why does it only exist in Christianity?
I'm sorry, why is it what?
I don't know of anybody in Judaism, in Islam, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, or any other major faith, Zoroastrianism, who is promoting intelligent design other than Christians. And a small sect of Christians at that, and I'm sure you'll acknowledge that as well.
Well, I'm suggesting that intelligent design be taught in the schools along with the theory of evolution. Not any religion or any religious-based concepts, but intelligent design, which is somewhat similar to the scientific method. In fact, before about 150 years ago, before Darwin came along with his revolutionary ideas, science was in agreement with religion.
Well, as long as Newton didn't want to get burned at the stake, yeah. But I mean, you have Richard Leakey right now in Kenya trying to stop the National Museum from putting their hominid fossils in a back room because the Christian Church in Kenya is calling on the museum to do away with the old fossils. I mean,
No. You don't want to do that.
Okay, Ronald Rollins is the author of God, the Intelligent Designer. Thanks for being with us today, sir. Good speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
What a friend we have in W.
Oh, yeah, our friend in W.
Upright, strong, and resolute. God wished him to be our leader.
The Supreme Court just had to follow suit.
Not but follow suit.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down.
When the day of choice
arrives. So the day of choice did arise last November. That clip, by the way, Paul Wehrig, the Republican strategist, speaking in front of a church, saying, no, we don't want people to vote. And no, we don't want people to believe in science either. Today, James Inhofe, on various headlines, Mark Morano, who's a regular on this program, in fact, used to be with CNS News. He's now Inhofe's right-hand man. In fact, he was on our program a week ago about global warming, saying it's a myth. It's a hoax, to quote Mr. Inhofe. Yes, global warming, it's all a hoax, don't you know? And so is evolution. And here's what, you know, at the surface it sounds like, you know, this is kind of a cute thing, you know, isn't that, you get some eccentric, you know, it's, but this, just a straight up news story. The Associated Press, famed paleoanthropologist Richard Leakey is giving no quarter to powerful evangelical church leaders who are pressing Kenya's National Museum to relegate to a back room its world-famous collection of hominid fossils showing the evolution of humans' early ancestors. Leakey called the church's plans, quote, the most outrageous comments I have ever heard, end quote. He told the Daily Telegraph of London, quote, the National Museums of Kenya should be extremely strong in presenting a very forceful case for the evolutionary theory of the origins of humankind. The collection it holds is one of Kenya's very few global claims to fame, and it must be forthright in defending its right to be at the forefront of this branch of science. He used to be, by the way, the director of Kenya's entire museum system. The museum's collections include the most complete skeleton yet found of Homo erectus, the 1.7 million-year-old Turkana boy unearthed by Leakey's team in 1984 near Lake Turkana in northern Kenya. The museum also holds bones from several specimens of Australopithecus amanuensis, believed to be the first hominid to walk upright 4 million years ago. Together, the artifacts amount to the clearest record yet discovered of the origins of Homo sapiens. Leaders of Kenya's Pentecostal congregation, with 6 million members, want the human fossils de-emphasized. As Bishop Boniface Adoyo, head of the largest Pentecostal church in Kenya, the Christ is the Answer Ministries said, quote, the Christian community here is very uncomfortable that Leakey and his group want their theories and their fossils presented as facts. Our doctrine is not that we evolved from apes, and we have grave concerns that the museum wants to enhance the prominence of something presented as fact, which is just, in fact, one theory. End of quote from the bishop. Leakey said these comments were outrageous, calling members of the Pentecostal church fundamentalists. He said their theories are far, far from the mainstream on this. They cannot be allowed to meddle in what is the world's largest leading collection of these types of fossils. So here you have this museum now caught in crossfire. And along these same lines, if you go to BuzzFlash.com, BuzzFlash, you know, one of many fine progressive websites, they're funded in large part by people buying books.
which I think is kind of cool. And so a couple of years ago, I said, you know, hey, I'll write a book review for you every month if it'll help. Actually, they solicited me, and I said, I'd be glad to do it. And so for every month for, I think, about two and a half years now, there's quite a few of them there, I've written a review of a book that's my recommended book of the month. And my book of the month this month is a little pocket edition. You literally can put it in your shirt pocket. Of the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, and Thomas Jefferson's Virginia Bill Establishing Religious Freedom, 1777. And the bill for establishing religious freedom is brilliant. Jefferson writes that to compel a man to furnish contributions of money for the propagation of opinions which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. Now, keep in mind, these are Jefferson's words at the same time that George W. Bush has started his Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, where we have given over, last year, in the last election cycle, over $1 billion, $1,000 million to churches to promote Republican agendas, including arguments against evolution and against global warming. Thomas Jefferson, this is from the Virginia Resolution, that to compel a man to furnish contributions of money, that would be your tax dollars and mine, for the propagation of opinions which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical, and that even the forcing him to support this or that teacher of his own religious persuasion is depriving him of comfortable liberty. The truth is great and will prevail if left to herself, that she is the proper and sufficient antagonist to error and has nothing to fear from the conflict unless by human interposition disarmed of her natural weapons, free argument and debate cease. And you know, and then they go in through this whole thing saying, we, the General Assembly of Virginia, do enact that no man shall be compelled, etc. And this was so important to Jefferson that on his tombstone it doesn't say President of the United States. It says author of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, Father of the University of Virginia, and author of the Declaration of Independence. 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you, speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone in Little Beirut, as Bush Sr. calls Portland, Oregon. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to decide whether a challenge can go forward arguing that President George W. Bush's faith-based initiative violates the constitutional requirement on church-state separation. This just in January 2001, right after he became president, Mr. Bush issued an executive order. This was not an act of Congress. It was an executive order creating the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives and similar centers in a number of federal agencies. The lawsuit says administration officials violated the Constitution by organizing national and regional conferences at which faith-based groups were singled out as being especially worthy of federal funding due to their religious orientation. It says the officials made public appearances and gave speeches throughout the United States intended to promote and advocate funding for religious groups. At the same time, in August of last year, George W. Bush came out and said that he believed that intelligent design was the way that science should be presented. In fact, John West, an executive of the Discovery Institute, Seattle-based think tank supporting intelligent design, said, and I quote, President Bush is to be commended for defending free speech on evolution and supporting the right of students to hear about different scientific views about evolution. End quote. This is what George W. Bush said. He said that the federal government should not tell states or school boards what to teach, but scientific critiques of any theory should be a normal part of the science curriculum. And what did Thomas Jefferson have to say about that? Well, when he was writing about in his autobiography, and then we're going to pick up your phone calls here in just a second. He was writing in his autobiography about the time when he came up with the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom. He said, by the time of the Revolution, a majority of the inhabitants of North America had become dissenters from the established church. But the first Republican legislature, which met in 1776, was crowded with petitions to abolish the spiritual tyranny. He's talking about compulsory taxation to give money to churches. These brought on the severest contests in which I have ever been engaged. Our great opponents were Mr. Pendleton and Mr. Nicholas, honest men, but zealous churchmen. He says the petitions were referred to the committee in the whole House in the state of the country, and after desperate contests in that committee almost daily from the 11th of October to the 5th of December 1776, we prevailed so far only as to repeal the laws which rendered criminal the maintenance of any religious opinions. For although the majority of our citizens were dissenters, as has been observed, a majority of the legislature were churchmen. He also points out that the preamble to his Virginia law establishing religious freedom, which starts out, the opinions and belief of men depend not on their own will, but follow involuntarily the evidence proposed to their minds, that Almighty God hath created the mind free and manifested his supreme will, that free it shall remain, by making it altogether insusceptible of restraint. This is how it begins. And so he says, whereas the preamble declares, this is in his autobiography now, Jefferson, that coercion is a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion, an amendment was proposed by inserting the word Jesus Christ so that it should read, a departure from the plan of Jesus Christ, the holy author of our religion, end quote. The insertion was rejected by a great majority. I'm now still reading from Jefferson's autobiography. That insertion was rejected by a great majority in proof that they meant to comprehend within the mantle of its protection the Jew and the Gentile, the Christian and the Mohammedan, the Hindu and infidels of every denomination. And then he goes on to say the restoration of the rights of conscience relieved the people from taxation for the support of a religion not theirs. For the establishment was truly of the religion of the rich, the dissenting sects being entirely composed of the less wealthy people. So this is not a new argument. 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM, our telephone number, and Tim in San Francisco, California. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great. Well, thank you, Tim, for calling.
Total progressive.
There you go.
All right, bro. Hey, I'm talking about the gentleman you had on before.
Yeah, Mr. Rollins.
Right, right. See, I'm not a creationist, but I am not in favor of how, evolution is being taught in our schools to our children. It's not being taught accurately. Now, I started doing some research about a year ago, and I was very skeptical at first, but the more and more I've read, the more I'm convinced that, this world has been destroyed a number of times. I think the Indian people, indigenous, Southwestern Indian people, they believe that it's been like seven times. I think four from natural disasters, three from man-made.
Well, we know five, mass extinction events, the last one 65 million years ago.
Well, I'm talking about the extinction of man also. This is, I have been finding more and more proof of, from records, from newspaper articles from the past. Like back to the 1800s and stuff.
You're suggesting that humans once coexisted with dinosaurs?
Well, I can tell you why I believe that. Because like in Australia, now this is just a small piece of it. For years in quarries where they're digging for rocks, they have been finding giant skeletons of human beings in there. In fact, the tallest one I read about was as tall as 25 feet.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the book Forbidden Archaeology. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's not what I have been reading, though.
Yeah,
I've been going on the web and just reading each thing.
Well, Tim, I got to move along, but, thank you for your opinion, and, respectfully, I'd say don't believe everything you read on the web, but, who knows? Who knows? Who knows? David in Blaine, Washington. David, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. You're Mr. Rollins. He's entitled to, his opinion like every red-blooded sovereign American, but he's not entitled to his own facts. And in listening to him, I found a quotation from Thomas Jefferson, not completely related to what he was talking about, but says the it was from John Adams. You have rights antecedent to all earthly governments, rights that cannot be repealed or restrained by human laws. Rights derived from the great legislator of the universe.
There you go. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, David. Terry in Springfield, Oregon. Hey, Terry.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I had to comment on your guest with his quoting Peter saying a day is like 1,000 years.
Yeah, I
think these guys not only need to take more science, they need to start taking some literature courses. Anybody would know that that's a simile for the vastness of God.
Yeah.
He could have just as well said a day is like 1,000,000 years.
Yeah, although the concept of 1,000,000 was probably one that wasn't well known
exactly,
at that time.
Exactly, and that's true. And the other thing is, it actually says in Genesis, there was a day and a night, and that was the first day. It actually says day and night, like there was a period of darkness and light,
mm-hmm.
as if the sun went down and then came back up. And also, if you pay attention closely, there's two different creation stories in the first.
That's right. Genesis actually tells two. Yeah, you're right. There's two different creation stories.
The first one has the man, the animal, it tells the order of animals are made first, and then man brought in. And the second one actually has man in there, and then he brings the animals to keep them company, and then adds the woman.
Right, and the thing that always baffled me about Genesis was then when Cain got sent away, he went off and found a wife.
Right.
You know, from another people nearby.
Right. Yeah,
and so what you get is that the story in Genesis is not the story of the origin of humans, it's the story of the origin of one particular tribe, because every tribe has an origin story.
Right.
And that just happens to be the origin story of that particular tribe. Terry, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Carl in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Carl.
Hi, Tom. First-time caller.
Well, thank you for calling.
I guess I'm just really scared and in a lot of ways concerned that some of these religious leaders,
including George W. Bush right now, by the way.
Exactly. They're able to influence our policies and our way of life with just their way of thinking, which I just don't understand their way of thinking, because it's completely illogical to think that all of a sudden we just sprang to life and there's no evolution involved. So what you see today is what God did the first time.
Yeah. Yeah, now I see, and that posits that there is a single intelligent creator as well, which is also
exactly.
Something that's debatable. There are, you know, monotheists, polytheists, and non-theists. So, Carl, thanks for the comment. Charles in Georgetown, Kentucky. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Tom. I wonder if I might steer the conversation away from evolution for just a second and see if you've had a chance to give any thought to what it would take to separate the politicians from the money, so that we wouldn't have the best government that money could buy.
Yeah, the problem is the First Amendment and the fact that the Supreme Court has ruled that money is speech. And what we need is a new Supreme Court, and we're certainly not getting that from George W. Bush. That's a whole other issue. We'll deal with it another time. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Hi, Sam. We just
have a half a minute left before we have to take a break here.
Okay, I'm definitely progressive. Love listening to your show every day. I am an intelligent design advocate. I don't think intelligent design advocates should push for it being taught in public schools, because then it just looks like a religious agenda.
Mm.
Intelligent design theory is not really religious. In fact, the first person who came up with it was Fred Hoyle in 1982 in his book Evolution from Space, where even though he didn't believe in God, he thought that life had been intelligently designed by other finite beings further back in time.
Mm.
So,
well, Scientologists are kind of into this too, right? That 10,000 years ago, the people from the planet Xenon or something came here and dropped off human beings.
Right. And so, So you have all sorts of weird theories, and the question is, is there evidence of intelligence, and how do you decide that? And that's what the theory is about.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, Julian, thanks for the call. It's, you know, should we have comparative religion? Should we have comparative science classes? Should we let George W. Bush just teach us all? It's 45 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back.
Oh, you better watch out. I'm telling you why. The FAA doubts that Santa will fly. Santa Claus is coming by ground. His bags were too weird. They're posting his bum. They're checking his beard. He's getting the one. Santa isn't leaving the ground. He'd take a flight if he could. They thought his suit looked weird. They profiled him as bad, not good, just because of his long beard. They'll post a reward, cause last time he flew, he tried to board his sleigh with shampoo. TSA does not like his ilk. He might bring on some cookies and milk.
Oh, heaven forbid! Welcome back, 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where being progressive never felt so good. In the meantime, we have Dennis Prager out here spreading hate speech, writing that Keith Ellison, the first Muslim member of Congress, who chose to have the photo op. When you're actually sworn in, there's no Bibles involved. It's not in the Constitution. It's not in law. In fact, it's a totally non-religious thing. In fact, the Constitution specifically says that there should be no religious test for people in government. None. So anyhow, when you're sworn into Congress, you simply raise your hand. But afterwards, a lot of people will pull a Bible out, put their hand on it, and have their picture taken. In the case of Oregon Senator Smith, he used the Book of Mormon. Probably Orrin Hatch did as well. Who knows? But Ellison says, for the photo op, I'm going to use a Koran because I'm Muslim. And so Dennis Prager writes, insofar as a member of Congress taking an oath to serve America and uphold its values is concerned, America is interested in only one book, the Bible. If you are incapable of taking an oath on that Bible, don't serve in Congress. Well, it turns out Prager is also a member of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council. It's funded with your taxpayer dollars. It oversees the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. And the Council on American Islamic Relations says no one who holds such bigoted, intolerant, and divisive views should be in a policymaking position at a taxpayer-funded institution that seeks to educate Americans about the destructive impact hatred had and continues to have on every society. So they're calling for Prager to be pulled off the board of this organization. I'm telling you, the pervasive influence of religion on politics is something that Thomas Jefferson warned us about, and George W. Bush is demonstrating the danger of. Mary in the San Francisco Bay Area. Hey, Mary, welcome to the program.
Oh, yeah, hi. I've got this on speakerphone, so maybe I should turn that off.
Yeah, it's better to just pick it up. What's up?
Is that better? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, well, I felt obliged to introduce one more thing to the conversation, intelligent design, because I have read Quran, and I'm stunned and surprised very often by what I find in there about creation. And just the other night I was seeing the mention of the creation was in different levels, like there was the water period, and then the two-legged, and then the four-legged. And then, but one thing that really strikes me overall is the expression Lord of the Worlds, which is repeated over and over, which gives the plural to worlds. So,
are you suggesting, Mary, that the Islamic creation myth is one that encompasses much more than 13,000 years?
Well, yeah, it's open to that open-minded interpretation, because when you say worlds, that opens your mind to say, well, there's a lot we don't know.
Good point.
If you find bones buried in the earth that, dinosaurs, I don't think they were scared or worried when that happened because, there's one of those worlds.
I see. Interesting. Mary, thank you very much for that. That's an interesting heads up. Craig in Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, Craig.
Hi. A couple things. The thing in AP News this morning was talking about birds evolving in metro areas.
Right.
AP News this morning.
Yeah. It has.
And if they don't believe in evolution, I can see that they're not evolving themselves.
Yeah, okay. Good point. Thank you very much. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia. Listen
on
Talk City in Sacramento there, KSC.
Yes, that's correct. Tom, in regards to your last guest, remember you asked him why other religions didn't promote intelligent design in their theories.
Mm-hmm.
And remember he had that long pause. And then he ended it with how many times in the past religion and science have come together before. Now, I haven't taken astronomy in a long time, but if you remember, Tom, the basics, Galileo, Copernicus, how many astronomers were jailed for saying things like the sun was the center of the universe?
Or that the earth was round.
It
was Pope John Paul II who pardoned Copernicus.
Exactly.
I mean, that was just like, 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
That Copernicus was finally pardoned. He was finally allowed to get into heaven. He was out of purgatory.
And it's so funny because, today with our technology, we know these things to be true. All these things that the ancient Greek philosophers even said, Plato and all these many other philosophers have said are true today. But have we not learned our lessons that, when religion tries to mandate these ideas, some of them may be true, who knows? But the point is, it's not science.
Yeah.
And if people want to go back to these days, I mean, this is where we're headed. I mean, it's very sad.
No, it's not just where we're headed, Patricia. It's where we already are. Thank you very much for the call. Matt in Sacramento. Matt, you're gonna have the last word here. We've got to wrap up this hour here.
Okay, we'll make it quick. This isn't about spirituality. This is about political and economic power. And whether it's the Church of Rome or an international corporation, that's really what this is about. And both sides have an axe to grind, whether it's creation or evolution, on who rules. That's all this is.
Yeah,
spirituality is personal.
You believe so, and I believe so, but George W. Bush spent a billion dollars promoting Bush.
So we can leave that alone.
but he's our idiot. I mean, we have to deal with the reality. You got James Inhofe out there, who's the head of the Senate Science Committee, the Environmental
God
Committee.
Help us all. That's all I got.
Yeah, amen, Matt. Thank you. I mean, you got James Inhofe out there, who's the head of the Environment Committee, who's supposed to be doing something about global warming, holding hearings this week where he's bringing forward all these people who are saying global warming is a hoax. What's his answer to what to do about the fact that carbon dioxide is spiking? He says, well, you know, God will take care of it. That's a verbatim quote, or close to it. God is still here. We need not worry. Well, you know, I consider myself a person of faith. And I want to make sure that I leave a decent planet for my children and grandchildren. 57 minutes past the hour. I'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, if Terrence McKenna is any authority on the topic, and frankly, having read several of his books, I think he is. Well, Terrence McKenna is now departed. He died a year or two ago, or maybe 3 years ago, of a brain tumor, but a brilliant writer on the issue of psychoactive drugs. You could use, according to McKenna, you could use psychoactive drugs to find out what the true origin of life was and whether or not we were intelligently designed and all those other issues of the last hour. Gary Fisher, writing on Rethinking Our War on Drugs, candid talk about controversial issues, his new book, but that's the title, Rethinking Our War on Drugs, is with us. Gary, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks for inviting me, Tom.
We have... We started in the 1930s here in the United States, starting in the late 20s, early 30s, this aggressive campaign of criminalizing drugs. It started out with cannabis. There are some who suggest that the original war against cannabis was on behalf of cotton manufacturers or people who wanted to do away with hemp as a competitor. There's others who point to Harry Anslinger's quote that, and I'm quoting Harry Anslinger now, the first anti-drug guy in the United States. He says that marijuana is used by musicians, not good ones, but the jazz type. And in other words, he's referring to African Americans. In fact, he went on to say, quote, marijuana will make white women want to have sex with black men, end quote. And this kind of racism and economic domination seems to be at the source of our cannabis laws. Where are we at right now, and where do you think we should be going?
Well, where we are right now is with a failed policy, and it's been a failed policy for a number of years, Tom. And there's a denial on the part of the administration and the office that runs our drug control policy, the Office of National Drug Control Policy. They won't admit that the policy is a failure. They won't look at alternative strategies and activities to make the strategy better. And so we're kind of at a standstill, and yet the administration wants to convince the public that we're making progress in our drug control policy, when in fact the evidence that I supply in the book shows that in every case the mandates that Congress has given, which include reducing drug use, reducing drug availability, and reducing the consequences of drug abuse, we've made little, if any, progress, and in a lot of areas we've gone backwards.
Mm. Yeah, and in fact, right now, we've been talking for a little more than a minute and a half right now, so about two people have been arrested just for use of cannabis, one every 40 seconds, 88% of all marijuana arrests for possession. And recently, there was a Zogby poll that found that more than 65% of Americans are in favor of decriminalization of marijuana. Broadly, now I've just been speaking of pot. Obviously, there's this whole panoply of drugs out there, from the highly designer and pharmaceutical variety to the natural substance variety. What do you suggest, Gary Fisher, in your book, Rethinking Our War on Drugs, we should be doing? Are there models out there? For example, is the Dutch model one we should consider?
Well, there are models, but we need to incorporate some of the best things about those models and do some different things, too. One of the first things that I suggest in the book is that all the supply reduction activities, which have totally been a failure, should be removed from our national drug control policy. Those are...
In other words, stop dropping napalm on farms in Colombia and...
Absolutely. What we're doing is alienating peasant farmers in Colombia and Afghanistan. It's doing absolutely no good.
Yeah, I guess it's Agent Orange, not napalm. Pardon me. Go ahead.
Well, fumigating those crops. It's not doing any good, and we alienate those peasant farmers who are poor, and they're growing those crops to subsist.
Right.
So we need to take the supply reduction activities and remove them from our policy. They involve the military. They involve foreign policy. They have no place in this policy. Second thing is I think that alcohol needs to become a part of the mandate of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Alcohol is a drug. It's a major drug that causes the most problems among young people, and yet the alcohol industry keeps the mandate of the Office of National Drug Control Policy from considering alcohol.
And tobacco, nicotine is 5 times more addictive than heroin. Nicotine should be considered a drug, too, should it not?
It certainly should be. The reason that I don't talk as much about tobacco is I'm really talking about mind-altering drugs that are causing problems in a number of areas, in addiction areas in our country. And tobacco... Really, the Master Tobacco Settlement Agreement took care of a lot of the problems of tobacco. We're seeing some resurgence now because the tobacco companies continue to market their products to young people.
Right, and they're fighting back.
Gary
Fisher, back in the early 1970s, I had a friend. I'll just refer to him by his first name, which was Stanley, who had started a company. He had a background in chemistry. And he had figured out a couple of fairly simple chemicals that he could make as a little reagent solution that if you put it on cocaine or pot, you could tell how much cocaine or how much THC was active as a substance. And he started selling these test kits through High Times magazine. And he was selling them for like $6-$8, you know, a package. It was probably 20 cents worth of chemicals. And the people he was selling them to in the early days were people who were using the drugs, you know, as a way of finding out how pure the stuff you were buying was. And I remember, and Stanley was just, you know, he was kind of a middle-class guy who had a science background, and he was making a little money on the side doing this. And then they started passing these laws mandating testing for drugs, and Stanley developed a test for, you know, where you could test the presence of these things in somebody's urine, and started selling his 6 or 8 cents worth of chemicals for $35 and $40, and having state governments require things like truckers to take these tests. Stanley is now a he's probably worth $300 million. And, you know, he sold out his business about 15 or 20 years ago. I remember when he did it. And he lives in this huge mansion in Bel Air, and he's living the high life. And it's all on the war on drugs. And I'm sure that my friend Stanley is not the only guy who has become a multimillionaire as a consequence of this so-called war on drugs.
No, of course not. There's a, you know, a whole industry about that maintains the current strategy, and it's got.
So how do we change things in the face of an industry, in the face of people like Stanley no longer has a vested interest because he sold out, but you know, were he still in business, I can guarantee you he'd be the first one to be down there lobbying to maintain the illegality of these drugs so he could keep selling his test kits.
Well, the thing that has to happen is the war on drugs, or you know, our drug control policy has really taken a back seat to everything else that's gone wrong in this country, and it's got to get to the forefront again. It is the number one public health issue in our country, and when it is ignored as a domestic policy, there is no way really to get the public aroused and concerned about what's going on with this issue. So public concern is the number one thing, and that's very tough to do in this current environment. The second thing that has to happen is I think that the drug czars have to be called to account for their misrepresentation of research, for their distortion of survey data, for the misstatements they make about what is actually happening on the war on drugs, and nobody is really holding them to account for what they are saying publicly, which is really not true.
Saudi Arabia is regularly executing people for possession of marijuana, as does China. These are the two countries that have put to death the largest number of people for possession of pot. This thing that started in the United States as a socioeconomic and race-based way of promoting the personal power of Harry Anslinger and his ilk has become an international, I lack a word, but there's an international consensus that we should all be horrified about people altering their consciousness with natural or synthetic chemicals. Shouldn't this be framed more appropriately as a medical issue and not as a legal issue?
As a public health issue. And I think if we looked at it as a public health issue, that would change a lot of things about our drug control strategy. Right now, it's a prohibitionist and a punitive look at our drug problem. European countries, most of the rest of the world, looks at drug abuse and drug use as a public health problem.
Yeah.
The United States doesn't. And that's part of what the problem is. And so we, with this prohibitionist mentality, we take things like medical marijuana as a very good example, where this is a substance that researchers, the Institute of Medicine, have said is a viable alternative for people that suffer from chronic conditions such as AIDS wasting and pain. And yet, consistently, the drug czar, John Walters, our current drug czar, runs around the country whenever there's a medical marijuana initiative and says that if we have medical marijuana, our youth will start increasing their use of this substance. There is no data to support that kind of contention.
Yeah, it's just raw hysteria. Gary L. Fisher, he's the author of Rethinking Our War on Drugs, candid talk about controversial issues. Good book and good work you're doing. Gary, thank you for being with us on the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. We'll be right back. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain, our program. Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some. You've got to be very careful about that. Live 5 days a week, 3 hours a day, noon to 3 Eastern time, 9 a.m. to noon Pacific time. No, we ain't going nowhere. Welcome back to our program. I remember a couple of years ago, I've been to Holland many times, actually. And one time walking into a fancy restaurant, just a fancy schmancy restaurant. This is actually right across the street from the big casino, which is right across the street from the Rijksmuseum, where Van Gogh's paintings are and things, the Night Watchman and whatnot. There's a very, very nice restaurant there. White linen tablecloth, the whole thing. And went in with my party and sat down. And the waiter comes over, the sommelier comes over, the wine steward, and he hands me two pieces of paper, two menus, the wine menu and the pot menu. And on one, there were all these different kinds of wines you could pick, and on the other, there was all these kinds of pot you could pick, from relatively, and it was all, priced by the gram, and they would bring you a little pipe or a pack of cigarette papers. And we had on this program about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, the chief of police of Amsterdam. In fact, I was just looking through our audio archives to see if we had the archive of it, but apparently we didn't record it. But he was on the program and he said, what happened when you decriminalized pot? And he said, well, first of all, we never decriminalized it because we couldn't be a member of the European Union if we decriminalized it. So we just made the conscious decision to not enforce the laws against it. Which I thought was an interesting statement for a chief of police to make. And he said, and we announced that we were not going to enforce the laws, but we had to keep the laws in order to be a member of the EU. And he said, but what we found was that teenage drug use went down. Because it was no longer the in thing to do. It was no longer the hip thing to do. It was no longer, you know, it lost its patina of ooh, that's forbidden. And pretty much right across the board, drug use went down. England had a similar experience when they decriminalized heroin. In England, if you're a heroin addict, you can get a shot of heroin for about 10 cents from any physician. The National Health Service pays for it. And what happened when they decriminalized heroin? It broke the back of organized crime. It took a huge chunk of cash out of that business. It reduced the level of petty crime, people, you know, stealing, breaking into your car to steal your stereo to buy a fix. And over the time, it has decreased the number of people who are using heroin. It turns out that there's always going to be a small percentage of people. I forget the number, 2, 3%, something like that. There's always going to be a small percentage of people in society who are biologically wired in such a way that they're going to abuse substances. They're going to end up, depending on what they're exposed to, alcoholics, drug addicts, heroin addicts, coke addicts, caffeine addicts, whatever. They, people who, you know, simply abuse substances. And then there are other people who experiment, and there are other people who use them for, you know, psychedelic, you know, spiritual purposes, whatever, things like that. Louise's coffee? What? Yes, coffee, caffeine, it's a drug. And it's time for us as a society, in my opinion, to simply recognize this fact and say, you know, we need to acknowledge this. We need to treat this as a public health issue. And we need to help people who get caught by these substances that are destructive, because there are some of them out there that are terribly destructive. Tobacco, for example, kills a 500,000 Americans a year. Worldwide, it kills millions every year. The most addictive drug known to man, nicotine. We need to deal with these things as public health issues, not as crime and punishment issues. I remember a friend of mine, Jerry, when we were teenagers. It was after high school. Jerry was 17, 18 years old. Got busted for pot in Michigan and went to prison. He actually went to the state prison for 2 years. This was when they were really cranking up the laws. This was in the early 70s. Or late 60s, really cranking up making much harsher the drug laws. And he got just caught up in this thing. And I remember when Jerry came out of prison, he was broken. He was not the person that I knew, that I had grown up with. We have a system that is destroying people. It is particularly destroying the lives of minorities in the United States. In many minority communities, as a result of endemic and systemic cultural and economic discrimination, you have communities of color, particularly African Americans, but also in Latino communities and other communities. You have communities who are suffering the effects of discrimination, and they don't have access to the kind of capital that other communities have to start businesses, and yet they have the entrepreneurial spark and spirit, just like everybody does. So they're going to start a business. What are you going to start a business with if you don't have access to a bank to loan you money? If you don't have access to traditional marketing techniques? Well, maybe you would start the business of selling drugs. And boom, off you go to prison. We need to be looking at this with a serious eye and thinking about these issues in a straightforward fashion, in an honest fashion. 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls after this. Indeed, 34 minutes past the hour of the Radio Support Group of By and For We the People of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 440-8466. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and hang out with some of the finest minds on the entire Internet, in the entire world, maybe in the galaxy. Sue, running our message board in our chat room, is actually over near London in Milton Keynes. Notes from the BBC, most of the heroin that is smuggled into the United Kingdom comes from Afghanistan. Heroin is a Class A drug under the Misuse of Drugs Act, which means it is illegal to be in possession of or supply heroin. Okay. So, and again, treated as a medical issue. Jeff in Richmond, California. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Well, on that note about Afghanistan, my opinion is I think that that's our rebuilding program on the cheap in Afghanistan. We just make sure that the heroin production is ramped way up, and at least some people will get rich there.
We're doing that. I mean, we have turned Afghanistan into the largest opium and heroin producer in the world, larger historically than they have ever been. I mean, they just produced the largest opium crop in the history of that country. It had actually declined substantially under the Taliban because Bush gave them $40 million in cash to cut heroin production,
right,
or opium production.
So there's our economic rebuilding program.
There you go.
But anyway, what I was calling about was the war on drugs. I agree with your guest. It is such an ignored issue, and unfortunately, with the civil liberties, abhorrent civil liberties record of this administration, it's totally taken a back burner. But I wanted to just point out a couple interesting things about it. I've studied this whole drug prohibition issue for years, and kind of almost a hobby of mine, a passion of mine, if you will. First of all, what's interesting is the nature of the word scapegoat and pharmacology actually have a common root. I don't know if you or your listeners are aware of that.
I didn't
know.
The word,
yeah, it's interesting. The Greek word pharmakoi is the basis for the word pharmacology, and a pharmakoi is actually referred directly to a scapegoat and to scapegoating rituals that the Greeks performed. You know, as we all know what a
mechanism. But scapegoating was a way of taking one's own sins and laying them on the animal so that the animal could then be killed and you would no longer be responsible for your acts, wasn't it? Or am I?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's the way I look
the
at
sacrificial
the
animal.
Yeah, I look at recreational drug users and, you know, folks that have gotten ground, like that friend of yours you were mentioning, as today's scapegoats. And I think there is more than enough etymological basis to really, obviously to bring that home. The other part is, I was telling your screener, the way I think of the war on drugs is that the best historical analogy that I've ever come up with, and I'm not the one who came up with this, a psychiatrist by the name of Thomas Zaz, S-Z-A-S-Z, came up with this. The best analogy with the war on drugs is the Spanish Inquisition. And that's kind of a depressing analogy because the way the Spanish Inquisition ended, I mean, it started in Spain, of course, but then it spread all throughout Europe like wildfire and lasted for a few hundred years, unfortunately. The only way it stopped was when sort of everybody realized that everybody was a witch pricker. That's the name for people who worked on spec for the church to kind of identify witches for burning.
Right.
And everybody sort of realized that everybody was in danger from this. It
right.
wasn't just the witches. It was everybody. And that's the way it stopped. Unfortunately, so much destruction, so many lives ruined in the process. I hate to say it, but I can't see any way out of it. You know, that's the way the war on drugs, I can see that's how it's going to end. And that's not a happy thought, but.
Yeah. Well, the simple thing is to simply incorporate the more serious drugs, caffeine. Actually, I don't consider caffeine all that serious a drug, but alcohol and tobacco into this category. Because these are major psychoactive drugs that are highly addictive.
Well, you know, you have a point there because caffeine, I always find that very fascinating, that caffeine is something we all do so...
Well, caffeine is my drug of choice, so,
right.
So of course, I don't want anybody messing with my caffeine. I want my coffee.
But how's this for a factoid? Cannabis, which, by the way, as you were quoting some figures on, is the... I mean, our war on drugs is primarily, if you just look at the numbers, a war on private consensual cannabis users, because you quoted those statistics.
Yeah.
Yet, what's interesting is that only a gram of caffeine can kill an average-sized male. Yet, you probably are aware of the figures on cannabis. I think extrapolating from rats, you would need approximately 60,000 times the effective dose of cannabis to kill a human being.
Yeah, my understanding is it has simply never happened. Nobody has ever died from an overdose of cannabis.
No, it hasn't happened. No.
Right.
So,
and,
yeah.
Which can't be said for a lot of other things. Although, frankly, I think it'd be, I suppose you'd have to have a weak heart or something to die from an overdose of caffeine. Most people, to get 1,000 milligrams of caffeine when you've got, about 200 milligrams in a cup of coffee?
A pack of Vivarin will do it, you know?
They'll
send you into atrial fibrillation, send you to the hospital, you might die right there on the table. So,
not a good plan. Not a good plan. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. By the way, Robert Gates, just go off topic a bit here for a moment. Robert Gates' confirmation hearings was asked by Carl Levin, who is the actually is going to be in January the chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the United States Senate, Michigan's Carl Levin. He's now the minority leader of that committee, the head Democrat on the committee. He said, Mr. Gates, do you believe we're currently winning in Iraq? Now, this is the guy who's going to become the head of the Defense Department, who has is charged with the job of finishing a job that we got to finish. We got that job that we started. We got to finish it. This is the guy that George Bush has selected to finish that job. And pretty straightforward. When Carl Levin asked him, Robert Gates gave him a straight-up answer. Here it is.
Senator Levin. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gates, do you believe that we are currently winning in Iraq? No, sir.
No, sir. Doesn't get much more straightforward than that. Are we currently winning in Iraq? No. Don't think so. Not going to happen. In the meantime, Smokey Joe Barton, the Republican from Texas, he says that he's going to continue to block Democrats from passing mandatory federal caps on heat-trapping greenhouse gas emissions. He says, I will be an active part of any leadership effort to prevent it from passing in the House. He was the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee. How do we get whack jobs like this? How do we get Looney Tunes characters like Joe Barton, who thinks, of course, he's from Texas and he's got all his oil money. But he says that global warming science is, quote, pretty weak stuff. He says, but for us to try to step in and say we've got to do all these global things to prevent the earth from getting any warmer, in my opinion, is absolute nonsense. It's not going to happen. And people continue to send this guy to Congress. Seeds of the plant Cannabis sativa, hemp seed, contain all the essential amino acids and essential fatty acids necessary to maintain human healthy life. No other single plant source has the essential amino acids in such easily digestible form, nor has the essential fatty acids in as perfect a ratio to meet human nutritional needs. Well, there's an interesting one. Should you go on an all-pot diet? Dave in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hey, just wanted to say, first of all, thanks. I just got back from Iraq, and I had emailed you about the civilian contractors there, the third-party nationals, and how they were treated, and told me to call you once I got back, and so I decided I would.
Tell us about it.
I didn't really see a lot as far as, you know, how they were treated on an individual basis, but their living conditions, the way I saw it, you know, most of our quarters had blast barriers all around it, and they were separated from we were separated from other quarters by a pretty good distance, and had sandbag walls around ours, and theirs were just pretty much almost piled on top of each other out in the open. That was
kind of distant. And these are people from what, the Philippines, Bangladesh, folks like that? They're imported workers from very third world countries?
Right, Tom. There was some from Nepal as well, Sri Lanka or Ceylon, whichever it is now. I forget.
And these jobs are not going to Iraqis because Iraqis would cost more for the contractors?
I'm not sure about wages-wise. They could probably pay them about the same, but definitely security checks and things like that would probably run up the cost there.
Yeah. I think that's bizarre, you know, that it was L. Paul Bremer who changed the Iraqi constitution to make it possible for a multinational corporation to go into Iraq and basically do away with all the immigration laws, bring anybody in from any outside country to do any work. And so we've got, you know, the largest construction project in the country, the U.S. Embassy compound is 100 and some odd acres with 20 some odd buildings that is being built entirely with non-Iraqi labor. And the Iraqis are really not happy with that.
Right. If I'm not mistaken, I believe that they also outlawed union organizing there as well.
Yes, they did. And they imposed a flat tax of 15% and did away with the progressive income tax. And the conservatives said, let's create a conservative paradise to prove that Harry Truman was wrong when he rebuilt Germany and Japan.
Right.
We just have about 20 seconds left, Dave, before we have to take a break. You wanted to talk about a different topic, though, when you called?
Actually, yeah, I called to say that with the intelligent design being taught, you know, wanting to teach that in biology classes, I mean, where does it end there? I mean, they might as well just teach, like, the evil spirits theory of disease transmission in medical school, and, you know, they could undermine the whole basis of our science if we have Trinity math where, you know, 1 + 1 + 1 = 1.
That may well be coming.
It could get to a ridiculous extreme, Tom.
Indeed. Dave, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for the heads up on what's going on in Iraq. Good talking with
you. Thank you for your service, Tom.
And thank you for your service to our country.
All right.
Good talking with you, Dave. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. The radio support group of, by, and for We the People, the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. We'll be right back.
Demand is up. Supplies are down. What I want is like crude and brown. I crave oil to get my kicks. Attack the rack to get my fix. I love oil. Oh, every ounce. Nuclear, I can't pronounce. When my twins go out for fun, I say don't drive, take Air Force One. Oh, we can't conserve it, we are just way too spoiled. Oh yeah. Globe is heating up, you know it's starting to boil. Gonna have to face it, we're addicted to oil. I saw the sign.
Indeed, welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, I've got a news bulletin for you here.
Go on.
In a newly leaked memo written by former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, just hours before he resigned from his position, Mr. Rumsfeld proposes firing himself as the cornerstone of a new strategy for the war in Iraq.
Brilliant.
Yes, the memo offers fascinating insights into the thought process of the embattled Mr. Rumsfeld, who suggests that victory in Iraq would only be possible if he were canned first. He writes in the memo, "We must demonstrate to the American people that we are serious about winning the war in Iraq, and one surefire way to do that would be by firing my butt." Mr. Rumsfeld goes on to say that his dismissal would result in jubilation among Democrats and Republicans alike, not to mention Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds. The memo offers other intriguing suggestions for shifting the strategy in Iraq, including a proposal to leak a different memo penned by Mr. Rumsfeld every day for the foreseeable future. By leaking memos written by me, we will succeed in taking the American people's minds off how crappy things are going in Iraq, and will instead make them see that I was right about everything all along. What do you think?
I think you should have kept the job on the basis of a memo like that.
Indeed. This is actually reported by Andy Borowitz over at andyborowitz.com. BorowitzReport.com.
Reporting. I have no doubt.
Yes, he's absolutely one of the most brilliant sources out there. So what's happening in Washington, D.C.?
A little bit of a confirmation hearing going on for Robert Gates to be defense secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that he will listen to he's kind of said he'll listen to everybody.
Now, he has said that in fact, we just played the clip a few minutes ago, Carl Levin saying, are we winning the war in Iraq? And he said no. How is that going over with the administration?
The administration hasn't officially reacted to that yet. It's probably reacting even as we speak. I'm not in the briefing today.
But he hasn't said
that we're officially losing the war either. So he's straddling that line, but he's not being quite as gung-ho as Rumsfeld was. But I don't think the senators want that, and I think that's the kind of answer that they will appreciate.
Yeah. What else is happening in Washington, D.C. we should know about?
Well, other than that, it's one of those sort of interim days, really. Quite honestly, all the eyes of Washington are on that hearing room, 216 Hart, for that hearing. The other thing that's going on behind the scenes is people trying to figure out who is going to be the successor to John Bolton at the UN as the U.S. ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
That's a parlor game for the next week or so until somebody is announced. And it needs to be fairly soon because Condoleezza Rice is in kind of a difficult position. She, two of her most senior aides, and I may pronounce their names wrong, one's called Zelik, one's called Zelico, the two Zs. They're both very senior people, and whatever one thinks of them in terms of their political leanings, they're both brilliant. They're both going. And now she's losing, whatever you might think of him, her guy at the UN. So now she's got no guys.
Yeah, that's got to be a tough one.
Come January, she got no guys anywhere.
And
so she wants somebody in that job, and I would imagine that she's politely made that known to the president.
She made a comment yesterday or the day before about writing a book when I'm back at Stanford University, she said. It's like she's already looking beyond being Secretary of State, like she's really not interested in this job. Do you think she might be going next?
No, I think she's going to hang on.
Yeah, out of what, loyalty to Bush?
I think out of loyalty to Bush. Out of this being the best opportunity of a lifetime, and also out of if she goes, you know, and they change horses again, it starts to look messy.
Yeah. Well, it's already looking messy. I mean, do you think that she really believes that she's doing a good job? For that matter, I mean, do you think that she's doing a good job?
I think that she's doing an adequate job. I don't know that she's doing a good job. Because I don't know what her mandate is when she's sent out into the field to do X, Y, and Z. I don't know what else she's got to do.
That is part of the problem, isn't it?
We don't know. We don't know. But I'm not sure how effective she is. I don't know what kind of respect she has around the world. Maybe she does, maybe she doesn't. But the fact that I don't get a sense of that just as a member of the general population says to me that perhaps she doesn't get that much respect.
You're a member of the White House press corps and an accredited White House reporter. What's your sense of the White House press corps, their take on her in general and the State Department as a whole?
Well, like everybody else, they call her Condi. You know, they don't call her by her last name. Most people they call by their last names. I always find that interesting when they call people by their first name.
Is that something that she has asked for? Is that something that she has asked for? I mean, sometimes people call somebody by their first name because they ask them to, or call them by a, you know, Jimmy Carter said, call me Jimmy, not James Earl Carter, you know, that kind of thing.
No, I think it's simply because Condi's what she's known as. The State Department's got a whole separate crew of people. I don't think that they hold her in much reverence, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, interesting. So Bush has Gates now.
Yeah.
And he's got to figure out who's going to replace Bolton. And in the meantime, his father breaks down yesterday.
I don't know the story of this very well, but yes, his father broke down and cried.
Speaking of Jeb.
Yes.
You wonder if what was behind that was, if only Jeb had become president.
Oh, Tom.
I mean, that was the original plan, you know.
That's a Greek opera you've got right there.
Oh, yeah. Or Shakespearean. It's because Jeb was the Project for New American Century. I mean, he signed on to that because they were expecting that he was going to be president in 2000. So, who knows?
None of us will ever know because of that problem to keep their mouths shut.
Yes, there you go. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria. Good talking to you today. We'll be back after the news with Robbie Batra. Is the dollar going to collapse? Your calls, more news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, the BBC just came out with a new report by Andrew Walker, economics correspondent. The richest 2% of adults in the world now own more than half of all household wealth. That's on the planet. And the poorest half of the world's population own only 1% of the planet's wealth. A startling disparity, shall we say. What are the consequences of this? The dollar seems to be in free fall. There's concern around the world about what's happening with the dollar. The price of gold is going up. The price of oil has nearly tripled over the last few years. A lot going on. I wanted to get Robbie Batra on here, an economist who I have tremendous respect for. He is a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, the author of 5 international bestsellers, his most recent book, Greenspan's Fraud, and a brilliant piece of work it is, Robbie Batra. Dr. Batra, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
I should have started by saying, and welcome back, friends. It's 7 past the hour, and I'm Tom Hartman with you as well. Dr. Batra, well, first of all, one of the folks in our chat room, when I had mentioned before the break that you were going to come on the program, and one of the folks in the chat room said, didn't he in some of his books predict stock market crashes in the late 90s and a Great Depression in the 1990s? What happened with that?
Well, that's the long history behind it. I wrote a book in 1978. The title was The Downfall of Capitalism and Communism. And in that, I predicted that both systems will disappear in the long run, but Soviet communism would fall before the end of the century, And after that will come the turn of monopoly capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have used a variety of cycles in the past to make many different forecasts. And I've made about 30 to 35 different forecasts, of which about three have been wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you are able to miss. I think you should be allowed to miss something.
Sure. You can't bet 1,000. You have, however, accurately described the machinations of Mr. Greenspan and the so-called conservatives, starting with Reagan, the transformation of the American economy, essentially, from an economy that was designed to build a strong middle class, starting in the mid-1930s right up through the early 1980s, into an economy that is designed to benefit a very small, wealthy few and basically screw the middle class. And you've done a great job of describing the outcome of that. I'm curious what your take is on the current state of the dollar.
Well, currently, the economy is such that you have to borrow a lot of money to sustain it. And so the government is borrowing money from Japan, China, the whole world. American citizens are also borrowing money to finance their living standards. So the result is that we're borrowing so much money from abroad, and when the economy slows down a bit, the dollar is bound to fall, and that's what's happening right now. Our economy is slowing because there's a limited amount. The increase in debt cannot be sustained forever, and that's what's happening now. People are not able to refinance their homes, so spending is falling, and our economy is slowing down, and the slowing economy is a falling dollar. And I think that's very dangerous for our nation right now, because most of the negative things are coming right at this moment.
Right. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
As you said, falling dollar yourself, rising price of oil, and the huge debt with the rest of the world, and then the falling wages, rising poverty. I mean, you name it, one thing after another.
Right. Speaking of debt, in today's Wall Street Journal, an article by Ruth Simon and James Haggerty, the headline, "More borrowers with risky loans are falling behind." They're talking about subprime mortgages. These are mortgages that I guess are less than 10% down or given to people who don't have the very best credit history. And they note that subprime mortgage originations, that is brand new mortgages, climbed from $121 billion in 2001 to $625 billion in 2005. That's massive. And then they say the surge in mortgage delinquencies in the past few months is squeezing lenders and unsettling investors worldwide in the $10 trillion U.S. mortgage market. The pain is most apparent in subprime mortgages, but there are signs it's spreading to other parts of the mortgage world. They go on to note, how this came about, and then they said, Thomas Zimmerman, head of the asset-based security research at UBS, says we're a bit surprised at how fast this is coming unraveled, and they point out. They go through a whole series of these. Soaring delinquencies are making some lenders more cautious. Penny home sales dropped in October. They're down 13.2% from a year ago. Delinquency rates have been rising steadily since the middle of 2005, but the trend has accelerated sharply in the past 2 to 3 months, nearly twice the delinquency rate on new subprime loans recorded a year earlier. Do we need to be worried?
Oh, it should be very, very worrisome, because I think by the end of this year, or maybe in January, we will see some very, very negative effects of this unraveling. Because everything is based on debt. Mm. Everything is based on debt, and when your family income is falling, your wages are falling for the vast majority of the public, how can that kind of economy be sustained? So it's going to unravel very fast.
Which is going to make what? Debt less available? It's going to make it more difficult to borrow on your credit cards. It's more difficult to borrow against your home, and people are going to have to start living within their means? Is that?
People don't have assets to borrow money anymore. They're already pawned. They're already mortgaged. Cars are mortgaged. Homes are mortgaged.
Which means that if our current buying is being financed by debt and people no longer have access to debt, there's no more buying, which means that we slide into what, a recession or a depression?
Recession. I think we're heading toward a recession. The biggest danger to our economy is that many of our homes have been financed by foreign investors.
Mm.
When and billions of dollars of homes have been financed by foreign investors. when our home buyers default on these loans, foreign investors, they are not like foreign governments. Foreign governments will keep lending us money to in their own self-interest, but foreign investors are going to run away, to stampede out of our markets, and that could be mean a quick collapse of the
That would dry up the liquidity.
Totally.
And so for a middle-class family who is in debt up to their eyeballs but is living month to month on the one hand, or for a middle-class family that is doing okay but has some money invested, the two scenarios, what should the people who are hanging on by their fingernails be doing, and what should the people who have, you know, a couple hundred thousand bucks in the bank or a couple tens of thousands of dollars in the bank, whatever, they have a little bit of savings, enough that they could get by for a while, what should they be putting it in?
I would not take any risks at all at this time. I would put the money into bank CDs. I think they're fairly safe.
You would stay away from commodities like gold and oil?
Well, you know, if you have enough money to spare, then you can get into gold. Maybe 10% of your wealth can get into gold.
Yeah.
But if we are just getting by, I would save as much money as I can, not pay off debts. This is not the time to pay off debts. That was the time 2-3 years ago, try to clear up your debt. But now we're very close. We're almost on the brink of this unraveling that Wall Street is talking about, Wall Street Journal is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so very, very close to a big fall in the economy. So I would save money and then buy bank CDs,
mm-hmm.
1-year CD, 2-year CD, 5-year CD. You know, they're very safe because they're supported by FDIC.
But if the dollar is falling, I mean, why not buy CDs denominated in euros, for example?
Well, see, you're talking about investment strategy for those who have plenty of money.
Yeah.
I thought your question was, what if you're just getting by and you're
right.
Middle class?
Right.
For those kind of people, I would say save as much as you can right now. Don't worry about paying off your debts, because savings are the means for survival. Debt
right.
will be very hard to come by pretty soon.
Right.
Loans will be hard to come by. But, yeah, if you have plenty of investments, then I would buy bonds in euros or bonds in pounds. They are going to shoot up fast.
Yeah, and if you have debt, just, you know, operate on the assumption that it's going to go away at some point in the future, access to it, and so there's nothing wrong with having your debt maximized.
Well, I would not pay it off because you need
because
cash
then you reduce savings. Your own liquidity.
You need cash savings for survival. You know, who knows, the unemployment rate is coming up soon on Friday. This unemployment report,
right.
I think, is not going to be good. But the thing is that it's a debt-supported economy. Everything is supported by debt. And once things start to unravel, the debt-supported economy falls apart very quickly.
Wow. Ravi Batra, not good news, but this is what's been brought to us by Mr. Greenspan and his policies, right?
That's right, exactly.
Yeah. RaviBatra.com is website for more information. Dr. Batra, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks a lot.
Always good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour, even if it is a little sobering. On the Tom Hartman Radio Program, we'll be right back. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour. Over in our chat room, you can get to at tomhartman.com. Waddike says, Tom, won't the FDIC fail if the dollar does? Well, no, if the dollar falls relative to other currencies around the world, the internal consequence of that will be that everything in the United States that we import will start getting much more expensive. We will have to scale back our lifestyles radically. I mean, you could build a strong argument that we are living high on the hog in large part because the dollar has been so strong relative to other currencies, and so we've been able to get people in other countries to do things for a fraction of what it would cost to do them here, and, you know, the changing of our commerce laws as well. But it doesn't mean that the FDIC would fail necessarily if the dollar goes down. I don't think that Ravi Batra is predicting something quite that bad, some massive institutional failure, but rather a serious recession. But this is, I mean, there are a series of issues here that are not, that are interconnected, that are not disparate, that don't stand alone, each one of them. For example, Senator John Sununu, the Republican from New Hampshire, the guy who got elected as a result of the Republican Party committing crimes that they just recently were convicted of and paid fines for, the phone jamming in New Hampshire. Senator John Sununu asked about health care. What can we do about health care? He said, and I quote, "Stop complaining about health care. There is no solution," end quote. Yes, that's the Republican response. Today, in the front page of the Wall Street Journal, the front page, Dateline Bristol, Tennessee, on her 32nd birthday, just over a year ago, Monique Nikki White had such severe pain from lupus, a disease in which the immune system attacks healthy tissue, that she couldn't open her presents. 3 weeks later, a skin lesion spread around her body and her stomach swelled. She couldn't sleep. "Mama, please help me. Please take me to the ER," she howled, according to her mother, Gail Deal. "Okay, let's go," Mrs. Deal recalls, saying. No, I can't," the daughter replied. "I don't have insurance." In the morning, she had a seizure and had to be rushed to the hospital anyway. Doctors found that her kidneys had failed, her liver wasn't much better, and her intestines were perforated, a symptom of pancreatitis. These were the life-threatening side effects of either lupus or the drug that she was taking. Her rheumatologist prescribed it to her in June, telling Mrs. White to return every 4 to 6 weeks and undergo a CT scan so you could check for signs of damage from the drug. But she didn't go back. Why? Because she didn't have insurance that would cover it. The CT scan would cost Ms. White at least $2,000 if TennCare wouldn't pay. Each visit to the rheumatologist cost another $80, each blood test $183. She'd been too sick to work regularly for 4 years. Then they go on to point out, many Americans have health insurance, 47 million don't, but lots of people are in the messy middle, sometimes insured by employers, sometimes by government, sometimes not at all. Ms. White was left without health insurance just as her disease took a turn for the worse. While battling to stay alive and going from doctor to doctor, she had to navigate among government programs, private insurance rules, and hospital charity. Her case illustrates how arduous the American healthcare system can be, even for an educated person in a middle-class family. Unique, now this is where it gets very real, this article by Jean Zhang in today's Wall Street Journal. Front page of today's Wall Street Journal. Unique among developed countries, the U.S. delivers medical care through a patchwork of public and private entities paid for by another patchwork of public and private insurers. And then they go on to tell the story of this woman. She couldn't get private health insurance at any cost, her mother says. "I would have sold my house, but she wouldn't hear of it," her mother recalls. "We would have depleted everything. We would have done everything it took to get her better." And I'm not going to give away the end of the story. This is worth picking up a copy of the Wall Street Journal and reading it, because it makes it so real. What's going on in America? What's going on with our health care? What's going on with this whole incredibly messy situation brought to us by 26 years of the conservative war on the American middle class, and an unrelenting battle. I mean, it was 1947 was the year that Harry Truman, as President of the United States, proposed a national health care system, Medicare for all, a Medicare system that would cover every American. And we could have done it very inexpensively, and we can continue to do it relatively inexpensively. We have these blood-sucking leeches called health insurance companies that are sucking about 20 to 25% of our total health care dollars out of your pocket and mine and out of the health care system and putting them into the pockets of people like Bill McGuire, the chairman of the second largest health insurance company in America, who made $1.5 billion as a paycheck, $1,780 million. I mean, just think about that for a minute. $1,780 million, $1.78 billion, was his paycheck last year. And where is that money coming from? People like this woman whose story is being told here. soda makers are figuring out what I've been saying for years here on this program about high fructose corn syrup. I have to tell you about that after the break. And we'll be taking your calls as well. 1-866-440-THOM. 866-440-8466. 27 minutes past the hour.
Said Dick Cheney to the States of Red.
Do you fear what I fear?
Do you fear what I fear?
Bringing us words of fear and dread.
Do you fear what I fear?
Do you fear what I fear?
You know it's true. Liberals have no clue, and if more states start voting blue, terrorists will be thanking you.
Yes. Good old Dick Cheney. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Oh, my. As promised, a soda maker touting health moves to sugar. Betsy McQuay writing in today's Wall Street Journal. I've been pointing out for 3.5 years on this program that the rise of obesity in the United States, if you graph the rise of obesity in the United States, it tracks right back to, I was going to say the change in Coke. It's obviously it's not just Coke. But remember the New Coke? The whole thing about New Coke was a change from cane sugar to high fructose corn syrup. They had to, and they wanted to get the cane sugar out of it because the high fructose corn syrup was cheaper because of these huge government subsidies for corn, for growing corn. This is all about, you know, government subsidies in the marketplace and the invention of a technique to manufacture very easily and cheaply from corn high fructose corn syrup. And so, you know, Coke got the sugar out, cane sugar out of their product and replaced it with high fructose corn syrup. Everybody else did. It started showing up everywhere. And if you graph Americans' consumption of high fructose corn syrup on one axis and on another axis, you know, on one line over time, and then with another color, paint another line, which is the rise in diabetes and obesity in the United States, you'll find that there's a very strong correlation between the two. And in fact, I've had, you know, three and a half years ago started talking about this in this program and had people call into the program and say, you know, I just took corn syrup out of my diet. That's all I did. Not eating more or less or anything else. Just took that out. And I'm losing weight. So this now apparently folks are figuring this out. In their quest to reach health-conscious consumers, some beverage companies are turning to a surprising ingredient, writes Betsy McKay in today's Wall Street Journal. Sugar. Jones Soda Company, a Seattle maker of quirky soft drinks sold by Target Corp., and other retailers throughout the U.S. plans to replace high fructose corn syrup, a ubiquitous but demonized sweetener, with cane sugar in its drink starting in January. The move by Jones, which churns out blue bubblegum and twisted lime sodas, along with an energy drink called Whoopass, aims to capitalize on the bad publicity surrounding high fructose corn syrup, which some scientists have linked to rising U.S. obesity rates. HFCS sweetens Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many other foods and drinks. It has also become a lightning rod in the search for causes for the sharp increase in U.S. obesity rates. Some scientists have pointed out that its prevalence in the American diet rose along with obesity over the past two decades. I'm telling you, it ain't rocket science. It just ain't rocket science. Let's check what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq and the civil war thereof, and then we'll get to your phone calls. But first, our Iraq occupation alert.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Following our security and other developments in Iraq as of 1,000 hours GMT on Tuesday, this compiled by Reuters. Dateline Baghdad, mortar rounds hit a popular market, killing two people and wounding 10 others in the Qahira district. In Kirkuk, police found the body of a policeman who was kidnapped on Friday, buried in a house in Kirkuk. Two kidnappers were arrested. In Baghdad, a car bomb in a market killed two people and wounded nine in Amil district in southwestern Baghdad. Also in Baghdad, two mortar rounds landed in a market, killing two people and wounding five in northern Baghdad. In Mumadia, a car bomb in a vegetable market killed one person and wounded two others in that town. And Dateline Baghdad, three car bombs near a fuel station killed 16 people and wounded 25 in the southwestern Baya district. Gunmen ambushed a bus carrying employees for the Shiite Endowment, a religious body that oversees Shiite mosques in northern Baghdad, killing 14 people and wounding four. Insurgents attacked a U.S. patrol on Monday, killing one U.S. soldier and wounding five others in northeastern Baghdad. And the Iraqi army arrested 35 insurgents during the past 24 hours in different parts of the country, according to the defense ministry. Yep, things are going just, it's a little messy, as Don Rumsfeld would say. It's a little tragic. Sandra at San Francisco, California. Hey, Sandra, welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, sure.
What's
Thank
up?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, Iraq, in the hearings for on Gates, I keep hearing the word belief, such as, do you believe we are winning the war in Iraq?
Right.
Okay. Well, that's wrongly asked. It's not a matter of believing. It's a matter of knowing.
Well, the by using the word belief, what they do is allow for difference of opinions. I mean, there are... Well, yeah, okay, you're right.
Yes,
you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
I think we are looking for facts.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we are looking
well,
for
see,
facts.
Well, see, you have to keep in mind that the Bushies are quite famous for saying that they don't live in the fact-based world, that they make facts. They don't follow facts. They make facts. You know, this is an empire. We're creating reality as we go along.
Yeah.
And I think that they really believe that. I don't think George Bush has ever lived in a fact-based world. Or the fact that he's always, of the world that he's always lived in, is that there's always going to be somebody there to bail him out. Whether it was when he was going to Yale and he was hiring people to take his tests for him, whether it was when he was going to Andover and doing the same, whether it was when his oil company Harkin was failing and Osama bin Laden's half-brother bailed him out, whether it was when he was, you know, with the Texas Rangers and his daddy's friends brought him in and made him millions, whether it was governor of Texas and Jim Baker and Karl Rove were bailing him out, whether it was when he lost the election in 2000 and Jim Baker and John Roberts go down to and Josh Bolton go down to Florida and help him bail out the election. I mean, he's always lived in a world where he didn't have to take responsibility for anything.
Right.
It was always done for him. And they're going to do it again.
Yeah, well, so this type of wording used by our government should not be so.
Yeah.
Nor should the war in Iraq. I mean, it is.
No, it's not a war, it's an
occupation.
Yeah,
nor is it an occupational war. It's either an occupation or a war.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And in fact, I would say that when Bush and Sandra, thank you for the call and for making that point. It's an important point. When Bush stood up on the USS Abraham Lincoln and said,
"My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed."
Now, as I recall, that was May 1st of 2003. And he was right. When you invade a country, you knock over their government, you seize their government buildings, you defeat their army, you take possession of their country, you have won the war. We won the war. It was an illegal war, but we declared it and we won it. Actually, Congress didn't declare it. It's not enough, but you get the point. Then began the occupation, and we have totally screwed up the occupation. And I would submit to you that in large part, the reason why of how all that kind of thing that we screwed up the occupation so badly is because these cons went in and they changed the Iraqi constitution. They were trying to create a conservative paradise. They looked at what Truman and Roosevelt did after World War II, well, what Truman did and Marshall after World War II. Harry Truman in 1947 tried to pass a comprehensive national health care program, Medicare for all, and the Republicans refused to even allow him to have a vote on it. They instead passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which watered down the Wagner Act of 1935, which allowed for unions. They created the so-called right-to-work state exemption, with the Taft-Hartley Act. Truman vetoed that, and the Republicans who had taken control of the House and Senate in the election of 46 overrode his veto. So when Harry Truman helped put together the constitutions of Japan and Germany, he said you should give strong protections to labor unions, and you should have a national health care system. And they did. And they built two of the most powerful industrial nations in the world, second and third only to the United States. And the cons ever since then have been saying, that was just a fluke. We need a country where we've got a tabula rasa, blank slate we can write on, and we can create a brand new. And when they got control of Iraq, Paul Bremer went over there and he changed the Constitution in violation of international law, changed the Constitution to outlaw labor unions, to produce a flat tax, flat 15% tax, to allow corporations to do anything they want, to have absolute international free trade, open their borders to multinational corporations, open their borders to immigration of any kind. Any corporation could bring in any kind of labor it wanted from any country at any price. And they deprivatized things like the healthcare system and then the food support program and the schools. They had gradually deprivatizing all of these, or gradually privatizing all these things. Actually, not so gradual. And what was the result? They thought that it was going to be a conservative paradise. They thought everybody was going to go, wow, look at how smart these guys are. Iraq is working so well. We should do this in America. Do away with Social Security. Do away with labor unions. Do away with any kind of, you know, Medicaid and Medicare. Do away with all of that stuff like L. Paul Bremer did in Iraq. And America will become just like Iraq. And I'm telling you, if they did, it would. Back to your calls in just a second. 45 minutes past the hour.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the world that you cannot find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program. We're tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. I guess the Jeff Gannon jokes are getting kind of old, aren't they? John in Los Angeles, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say it's a pleasure to finally get an opportunity to speak with you. I've only been listening to your show for a few months, and aside from the issues, you're a true Renaissance man. You have a wide range of knowledge, and I especially appreciate and enjoy participating in your chat room.
Well, thank you, John, and thanks for hanging out in the chat room. And hi to everybody else in the chat room. Hey, everybody. So what did you call about?
Actually, I called hoping to speak with Dr. Batra.
I've read most of his work. I may be able to channel him for you.
Okay.
Maybe not.
I've been very concerned about the economy for some time. I've been in the real estate business since 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been quite apparent for at least the last 6 years minimum. The economy has, by and large, been run on basically, people have used their homes as ATMs.
Right, yeah, exactly. And Ravi Batra writes about that in Greenspan's Fraud and also in some of his columns. And you know, if your question is, where is this all headed, is that where you were going with it?
Well, where is it headed is any number of disasters
I would submit to you, John, that in all probability, one of two scenarios is going to happen. Either we're going to go into a recessionary, deflationary period where prices will fall.
Or hyperinflation.
Yeah, and that's the other one, yeah. The recessionary, deflationary, and it could even become a depression, where prices fall and liquidity dries up. It gets impossible to get cash. And all the pieces are in place for that kind of thing. And what drove that in 1929, what drove that in the crash of 1896, what drove that in the crash of 1856, or 1854, whatever year it was, just before the Civil War, in every case, was this huge disparity in wealth between the most wealthy and the average person. I mean, just these explosions of the era of the robber barons, and that's you know one scenario, one possible outcome.
The other is the
hyperinflationary one. And, you know, the government is just running the printing presses like crazy. They stopped publishing M3 in March.
Stopped publishing in the M3, and so we really don't know how much money they're printing.
That's right. Although we can get some sense of it by looking at the cost of commodities. And when you see gold going up, and you see oil going up, and all the metals,
everything is going up.
Yeah, copper. I mean, you know, right across the board, all the commodities, and then if you see, you know, the value of things domestically going down, you know that what's going up is the number of dollars in circulation. What's going down is the value of those dollars. John, I got to move along, but I thank you for the call. I appreciate it, and thank you for your kind words. Gwyneth in Eugene, Oregon, KOPT. Hey, Gwyneth, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to concur with your previous caller about appreciating your work and all the research that you do. It's very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to thank you also for the real-life story that you brought out of the Wall Street Journal about the woman with health issues. And there are so many thousands and thousands of stories like that. I work in the disabled community here in Eugene. And when Oregon legislature cut the Oregon health plan 3 years ago, there have been 30,000 Oregonians who had their health care withdrawn and have died as a result.
Mm.
And most
30,000 people who have died, or 30,000 lost their health care, and some of them died.
30,000 people have died, and that's 15% of the people who lost their health care.
Wow.
When Oregon's health plan went down, a couple of hundred thousand, I don't know that number, but I know that 30,000 is 15% of that. And that many have died.
Yeah, this is...
And they are working people who had disabilities and couldn't get private health care. Many of them are right in that borderline between middle class and just having enough support to keep your health going so you can keep working.
Oh, it's absolutely nuts. And not only that, and I just went through this. With the health insurance that I have through the radio station here, and they send out these questionnaires, you know, with this long list of have you ever had, right? And all this long list of diseases, and you just know that if you happen to check yes on any of those things, that they're going to say, okay, no disability insurance for you, or now you have a pre-existing condition, we won't cover it. I mean, you know, it's just,
right.
It is such a scam. It is just such a flaming scam.
The only kind of insurance you can get then is through the state. And you have to demonstrate
that you're broke to get that. So you have to throw yourself into poverty. You have to give all your money to the healthcare system first.
Exactly. You can own your own home. You can own one car.
Yeah.
And that's it. And then otherwise... It's the same thing
with America's elderly. It's, you know, people retire with a couple $100,000 thinking that that's their nest egg, and then they discover that's a year in a nursing home or 2 years in a nursing home, and then they're wiped out, and that's what they have to do, is they have to wipe themselves out completely. Gwyneth, I got to run, but thanks for the call. They have to wipe themselves out completely in order to be eligible for Medicaid so that they can continue to be in the nursing home, which means that they have no legacy for their children and grandchildren, nothing left over. They thought they were going to will something. That's the real death tax. It's hitting the middle class. Forget about the estate tax. The real death tax is the health care disaster in America. Coming up tomorrow, conservative Catherine DeBrecht on her newest book, Help Mom, the Ninth Circuit, Nab the Nativity. Yeah, well, that'll be an interesting one. And Orson Scott Card on his new book, Empire. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Maybe you see people listening to their iPods, white earbuds dangling from their ears, and maybe you don't have an iPod yet because you don't see yourself as that type of person. So are you the type that has a CD player or a 6-disc changer in your car? With that. Don't limit yourself.